Welcome to the CRE Exchange podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in this space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of the CRE Exchange. I'm Cole Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research at Altus Group. I'm joined by Omar El-Tarai, our Senior Director of Research. Together, we'll share the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. Omar, it's great to be with you. What do we got today?
So we have a full agenda for today's show. But before we dive into it, let me apologize if my voice sounds off. I think it's just the changing of the season. But on the agenda, we have a lot coming out of the Fed and the different Federal Reserve Bank districts, including the Fed Beige Book, as well as two surveys from the Philly Fed covering the business outlook surveys and their large bank credit card and mortgage data report, as well as some home builder confidence index data. And we'll close the call out with a special highlight of Canadian commercial real estate trends and a conversation that we had with our colleague, Peter Norman. But to kick it off, I'll dive into the Beige Book. So this was released on October 15th. The official name of this is the Federal Reserve's Summary of Commentary on Current Economic Conditions by Federal Reserve District, but everybody knows this as the Beige Book. And it really captures the current assessment of the economy in a qualitative format from across the 12 different Fed district banks. But the overall outlook, I would say, really varied by district and sector pretty significantly in this release, with some contacts really expecting an uptick in demand, but many others really continuing to expect elevated uncertainty to weigh down on overall economic activity through the end of the year. Now, if we break out the different kind of trends across major components of the economy and first look at the labor market, employment levels were largely stable in recent weeks, with demand for labor generally muted across districts and sectors. More employers reported lowering headcounts through layoffs and attrition, citing weaker demand, elevated economic uncertainty, and in some cases, increased investment in artificial intelligence technologies. Also on the labor front, employers who did hire noted improved labor availability and sometimes favored hiring temporary or part-time workers over full-time employment. Nonetheless, labor supply in the hospitality, agriculture, construction, and manufacturing sectors was reportedly strained in several districts due to recent changes in immigration policies. Wages grew across reporting districts, generally at a modest to moderate pace, and labor cost pressures intensified due to outsized increases in employer-sponsored health insurance expenses. Now, on the consumer front, some of the kind of national trends that were emerging across the districts included an overall consumer spending, particularly on retail goods, inched down in recent weeks. Auto sales were boosted in some districts by strong demand for electronic vehicles ahead of the expiration of the federal tax credit that ends at September. And demand for leisure and hospitality services and really demand from international travelers continued to fall, while demand by domestic consumers was largely unchanged. Spending by higher income individuals on luxury travel and accommodation was reportedly strong, but lower and middle income households continued to seek discounts and promotions, really in the face of rising prices and economic uncertainty. If you shift attention to manufacturing or activity, I would say that was pretty mixed across the districts. Most reports noted challenging conditions due to higher tariffs and overall kind of waning demand. Conditions in the financial services sector and other interest rate sensitive sectors such as residential or commercial real estate were overall mixed. Now, given that this is a CRE-focused show and our job is to focus on CRE trends, I went through and pulled out the CRE-specific commentary. And if you were to boil it up or boil it down and look at the high-level trends coming out of the Beige Book that were most relevant to CRE, CRE activity was generally mixed or flat across the districts, with notable differences in performance between sectors and different property tiers. Across the sectors, retail, medical office, and healthcare were really the bright spots in this Beige Book. Industrial as a sector was stable or a bit muted, and apartment and multifamily activity was mixed. The Dallas Fed noted that demand for multifamily was stable, but rents were under pressure from new supply. And the Cleveland Fed said that demand for multifamily was softening. In terms of commercial construction activity, it was colored as generally constrained across the districts, but a few high growth sectors were called out as seeing growth, such as data centers, which were mentioned by the Philly, Kansas City, and San Francisco districts, or healthcare construction, which was called out by the St. Louis and Kansas City districts. In terms of CRE operational performance or operating performance metrics, while there was a call out by the Cleveland and Boston districts about an uptick in demand for CRE and construction activity from the recent rate cuts, Boston and Richmond both noted that they were seeing impacts from elevated costs, both in terms of financing as well as in terms of operating costs that were challenging sales and new projects. When it comes to the Beige Book, you know, I think that this is a great report to provide color, but because it is qualitative, it is not necessarily easy to track specific and quantified movements. And so hopefully some of these kind of either validate or they're kind of broad brushes of what's happening. But some of the quantitative data that we did get was on the home builder confidence side, which, Cole, I know you broke down. What were you seeing in that data?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the reasons that I think is it's worth looking at this data is historically, it's been a very good predictor of single family housing starts. So it could give us a good idea of what to expect in kind of the months and the years ahead. You know, it tracks very closely with the actual hard data on housing that we are waiting for from the census. And once the government reopens, hopefully we get some of that. But this is an index from the National Association of Home Builders. It's called the Housing Market Index, but you broadly hear it referred to as the Home Builder Confidence Index. So they released data for October on the 16th, showing that sentiment climbed 5 points to 37. That was the strongest reading since April, but it is well below the break-even threshold. I think it's widely speculated that a lot of the uptick was actually due to a decline in mortgage rates. We've seen the 10-year Treasury yield drop over the last month or so. So this index is actually broken down into a couple of different components. One is for current sales, and that improved 4 points to 38. The six-month forward-looking outlook surged by 9 points to 54. The traffic of prospective home buyers was still pretty weak, but it did rise modestly to 25. And then there are a couple of other questions that they ask as part of this that don't directly go into the index. But one is builder incentives. 38% of builders reported price cuts. The average of price cuts was around 6%, hoping to stimulate the weak demand. NAHB also estimated that the October gain in the HMI could imply a roughly 3% increase in single-family permits on a seasonally adjusted annual basis. So some interesting numbers there. But I think that the takeaway for me here is that there's a little bit of rising sentiment. It is from super depressed levels, historically speaking. But I think there's some optimism that those ease in mortgage rates could help revise housing demand and really feed into broader economic momentum, because we've had some major affordability challenges here the last few years. But the HMI does remain well below 50. So any broader kind of recovery in home building is likely to be pretty slow. And it's also likely to be fairly uneven. So very limited anticipation here for new single family construction activity. We're definitely going to have prolonged supply shortages, ultimately keeping a lot of potential households renting. So some support for multifamily occupancy, some support for those stabilizing rents. I think some of that was alluded to in the Beigebrook commentary in select districts, but improved builder sentiment might point to a bottoming out in residential construction. We might be on the upswing eventually, but I would say this is fairly unlikely until financing conditions improve meaningfully. So a lot of the rental market is going to be the primary outlet for household formation for some time in the meantime. But a lot of good data in that home builder confidence index. I'm hoping we get some actual hard numbers on construction here soon, but we'll just have to wait. Now, Omar, you've picked up on one release that I don't think we've traditionally covered. So what was that one?
Yeah, so while the public banks are still reporting their earnings for Q3 on October 17th, the Philly Fed released their Q2 2025 large bank credit card and mortgage report, which really looks at the aggregate card and first lien mortgage information from the largest U.S. banks and holding companies, each with more than $100 billion or more in total consolidated assets. The Q2 report highlighted a growing financial divergence among consumers based on the card and mortgage data. Total credit card purchase volume hit a peak, but this growth really was driven almost exclusively by the high credit score borrowers. So those with credit scores of 720 or more. Cardholders with credit scores below 720 are spending significantly less in real terms than they were 2 years ago. While credit card performance, so this includes loss rates and delinquencies, has improved year over year, it's likely due to stricter underwriting practices at the banks than overall consumer health improving. In the mortgage market, new originations increased by a whopping 30% year over year. This is a high since Q4 of 2022, but really is primarily fueled by the larger loan size rather than a surge in the number of new loans. While a notable increase, the growth in the mortgage loan book is modest compared to historical norms and is largely attributable to 4.8% increase in the median loan amount. You can think of this as being driven by either larger homes or just higher priced homes, and is really not a massive surge in the number of loan originations. And then the final kind of takeaway is really that refinancing remains slow due to an overall high interest rate or mortgage rate, which is still around that 6% and 7%. Now, this is one of the best kind of breakdowns, at least from the bank data, in terms of the bifurcation of the consumer condition. Now, we definitely saw it in Q2 earnings, but I would expect to see it in Q3 earnings, where you have the lower end retailers speaking to a more challenged consumer picture and a more challenged consumer outlook, as opposed to the higher end retailers who, at least through Q2, were seeing less of a slowdown. But this report from the Philly Fed was the first time that I've seen a very clear breakout of the bifurcation in consumer financial condition through the banking channel and through the bank data. So that was something that caught my eye, thought it was helpful, and had time to explore it given the absence of other data. Cole, I know you looked at the Manufacturing Business Outlook Survey. What were some of the key trends there?
And this is one that we haven't covered before, so I think it's worth going over what the survey actually covers. But this is a monthly diffusion index survey of manufacturers specifically in the Third Federal Reserve District. So that's Eastern and Central Pennsylvania, Southern New Jersey, Delaware. And what's covered here is it asks manufacturers whether activity, new orders, shipments, employment, and prices are falling or rising. So it's a very early signal of where the industrial economy might be heading nationally. And again, it's a diffusion index, so any reading above zero signals expansion, below zero is contraction. So there, again, key components include new orders, so signal demand, shipments, output, employment or hiring activity, and then prices paid, prices received. So broadly, read that as inflation pressures. So data for October was released on the 16th. The headline index for current activities is what folks really look at here. And that plunged to -12.8 from +23.2 in September. So that was far below expectations for continued growth, which, you know, kind of around 10. But shipments fell sharply, even though new orders were positive. So demand hasn't really collapsed, but momentum in production has, which I think is quite interesting. So super weak survey. There's a general sense that growth is cooling, even as inflation pressures are easing. Investors interpreted this as a sign that the Fed may be on track to cut rates next week. The 10-year Treasury yield actually dove below 4% for the first time really since April upon release. And I think there's a couple implications here for us. I think direct CRE-related implications. If this is indicative of manufacturing activity nationwide, it could mean slower industrial absorption, increased caution among logistics-oriented tenants. But I think what most people were focused on here was the resulting drop in long-term yield. Again, they've ticked even further down since this was released. I think as of our recording right now, around 3.95% for the 10-year. So definitely could be some easing in financing costs, reviving some investment activity, but a short-term boost in capital markets, even if the real economy demand actually softens. But some certainly good signals here. But that's only one side of the coin. I know that they also released a survey on non-manufacturing business. How would you give folks an overview of that one?
Yeah, so they published the non-manufacturing business outlook survey on the 21st, and they collected the data from the 6th to the 16th. In terms of key takeaways, the non-manufacturing activity in the region softened overall. The indices for general activity at the firm level, new orders, and sales and revenue fell. The firms that participated in the survey reported an overall decrease in full-time employment and a rise in part-time employment. So that's something that we also saw in that Fed Beige Book. The current regional activity index declined again, given that this is a monthly survey. The October read was the 12th consecutive monthly negative reading. The sales and revenue index declined and turned negative for October, hitting the lowest reading since May. And then price indicators suggest continued increases in prices for both inputs and firms' own goods and services. So that was essentially what they're selling. And then the kind of final nugget that jumped out to me was they will periodically ask a special question. And this one had to do in terms of CapEx. And so nearly 39% of firms expect to increase their total capital spending next year. That's compared with 21% expecting to decrease total spending. And it really signaled that firms expect higher capital expenditures in the year to come. But there's a caveat to that. They expect to spend more on software and computer-related items, including like hardware, but have lower expectations for pretty much all other CapEx items. So that would include physical structures as well as any sort of like energy efficiency. So I thought that was interesting, and it cuts two ways for commercial real estate. But we've just covered a lot of survey, a lot of kind of qualitative and index data that ultimately paints a pretty mixed picture. I would say that there are a lot of mixed signals. We're recording this. We're more than halfway through October. We're closing in on the end of the year. And I would say ultimately, just there are a lot of mixed signals in the market, whether you're looking at manufacturing, non-manufacturing, or the service sector. If you're looking at the labor market, at consumer or corporate financial conditions, the macro picture overall seems pretty noisy. And I think that it's quite challenging to find kind of a sticky or cohesive or a dominant narrative. The current U.S. CRE narrative, though, seems to be a bit simpler. It's one of stabilization and normalization. So with financing costs coming down, the availability of credit improving, you have moderating operating performance across sectors. So that's cooling in some, but that's actually fine in others. U.S. CRE as an asset class is really starting to see and gain much more attention from across the capital spectrum. capital sources are starting to re-engage with the asset class and show interest. I'm sure we'll expound on that a bit more as we close out the year and really look forward to 2026. But even though we're almost always focused on the U.S., as we head into the end of the year, we do check in with our colleagues across our firm. And one colleague that we happened to check in with recently was Peter Norman. And we wanted to hear what he was seeing in Canada in terms of CRE trends. And now Peter just recently presented the full Canada State of the Market year in review and market expectations for 2026 on a webinar yesterday, October 22nd. I had a chance to connect with him prior to that to hear really some of the key trends that he's watching in terms of what characterized 2025, as well as what he still has on the radar for 2026. So here's a portion of that conversation now. Today, I'm thrilled to welcome Peter Norman, Vice President and Economic Strategist at Altus Group, where he leads economic consulting and forecasting for Canada's real estate and development sectors. Over a career spanning nearly 30 years, Peter's deep expertise spans land economics, housing markets, and valuation analytics. He advises both public and private clients across Canada on macro trends, policy, and real estate investment strategy. Peter, welcome to the show, and I'm excited to have a conversation with you about what's happening in Canada.
Thanks very much, Omar. It's really a pleasure to be here with you today.
So you have a fantastic perspective of all the changes that are happening, and you take this macro view as well as you will get in the weeds on individual projects. So could just see that being a phenomenal kind of overall holistic perspective. How would you characterize the current Canadian macro landscape?
Not too hot and not too cold. I think it's the kind of a landscape right now where if you pick up the daily newspaper and read the most recent headline, you're subject to either being overly optimistic or overly pessimistic because it can go either way depending on what data has just been released or what event has just taken place. Or, you know, we're very subject to what's going on in the U.S. So whatever the latest Truth Social post is or whatever can also, you know, affect people's outlook. But the basic facts are that we're in a kind of a soft landing economy right now. We've come through this interest rate cycle. Interest rates have started to come down. But because of the lags in the system and everything else, the economic growth has stalled earlier this year. We're probably still in that stall right now. But there are some green shoots coming forward. And it's not too bad, not too overly good right now. We've had a couple of months of employment declines in our labor market. And most recently, just a small uptick in employment. But overall, our year-over-year employment growth is still slower than recent averages, but it's pretty on par with pre-pandemic averages. The economy is still in a reasonably moderate spot, we say with that. There's some slicing and dicing on employment that we can complain about, but generally it's pretty moderate right now. With the lower rates, with some potentially a bit lower rates going on forward, I think there's some room to grow right now on the investment side, which has been lacking. We want to see a little bit more business investment. Certainly in this sector, we want to see a little bit more investment coming back into commercial real estate. But on the flip side of the coin, which is the consumer side, consumers have been pretty active actually throughout this soft landing. So they've been holding the economy from getting too slow.
What are some of the key risks that actually are on your radar and may not be hyperbole and that you think that there is some real kind of weight behind?
Well, I mean, the key risk to the Canadian economy right now is just the kind of chaos coming out of the United States. To put it colloquially, the trade tensions between Canada and the U.S. have had a real effect on Canada's economy. There have been some companies where production has been affected by the trade tensions and the trade actions. And there have been others which have just slowed down investment, let's just say, had time to pause because of the forecast haze that there is out there. At least for a while this year, it might be starting to get clearer now, but for a while, there's been this kind of wait where is it going to get a lot worse or is it going to bounce back really quickly? And that kind of uncertainty has led a lot of people on the business side, business investment side, to pause investments. And it has led consumers, even though consumers have been okay on the retail sales side to have paused or interrupted some of their big ticket items. And that's affected housing, particularly back in the spring. We saw the housing demand being affected on that side of it. So that continues to be one of our big challenges, is when is that environment going to become a little clearer? It doesn't necessarily need to get better, but a little clearer about where we're going. What's important to say that it's not just the trade tensions between Canada and the United States that might be affecting Canadian businesses, but there's been a slowdown in the overall growth in the world economy, and Canada is a small open economy. So whatever happens internationally affects us fairly acutely. And that continues to be an issue as well. So the latest reading from the IMF is that we're looking at 2026 being a modest acceleration in economic growth, again, for the same reasons, the clarity of this forecast haze. And we're looking in Canada as well with the lower interest rates to start seeing a little bit of momentum building, both on the investment side and then seeing consumers come back in on the major purchase side.
I can't help but draw parallels to the U.S. and the vibe session that we've been going through, where the soft data is indicating something that's much more dire and gloomy than actually the hard data. Would you say that you're seeing a similar thing in Canada, where that uncertainty is really being drummed up by the lack of clarity that you were talking about of how to interpret the kind of current events? And it's not necessarily what the economic kind of hard numbers and hard data is showing. Is that a fair parallel to draw, or do I have that kind of mixed up?
I think that's fair. I think that's sort of part of what I was trying to say, that there are some mathematical effects of the trade dispute, for example, like some companies will have reduced employment. So that's going to come through the system, depending on how many companies, how many sectors are affected and so on and so forth, we'll say whether it's systemic or not. But in general, I think the mood was very negative earlier in the year, in the springtime. And then as time marches on, people get more clarity. And, you know, I mean, there's a big uncertainty on the trade front still, because sometime in the next 12 months or so, there will be a kind of a renegotiation of the CUSMA trade agreement. That's sitting to the side of all of this, these little skirmishes. And, you know, that can go positively or negatively for the economy, I think. And that's going to be another big hurdle to try and get through.
From your vantage point, which CRE sectors currently look the most resilient, and which sectors look like they are either in distress or just under stress?
Yeah. So in general, things have slowed down quite a bit in the CRE sector for Canada, but it hasn't been all that even, and hasn't been all for the same kinds of reasons. So we're in a little bit of a slowdown on the industrial side right now, even though industrial still looks pretty good and still has a lot of like upside to it. But we saw the industrial sector was one that in the immediate pandemic and post-pandemic period got pretty significantly disrupted, but on the positive side, a lot of it attracted a lot of investment as it coped with a pretty rapid transition to e-commerce and other factors. And now we're seeing that just normalize. And so that's a little bit of a slowdown in that sector. Retail in Canada continues to chug along pretty good right now. I mean, it continues to attract investment. We're still seeing CapEx flowing into retail sector, and it's still attracting attention as that sector continues to kind of retool as well for modern realities. One of the things that really differentiates our retail sector from the United States sector is that Canada is fundamentally not overstored, not before the pandemic and not now. And I think that the US is significantly more overstored, or was, or anyway, is going through a transition dealing with that in a bigger way. So we have major retail shocks from time to time, demand side shocks that come from major store closures. Like, it's a small enough market that when you have a store closure, it can be disruptive sometimes across the country. And we've had that recently with a department store called The Bay that had stores all the way across the country. They all closed all at once. But those shocks tend to get absorbed pretty quickly when you're in a fundamentally not overstored environment. You see that space starting to get vied for other uses. So retail is doing okay. And the multifamily sector has slowed down quite a bit. And that's mainly on the revenue side, because we've seen rents come down in some of our major markets now by, you know, 15, 20% in some cases from that post-pandemic blip on rents. And there's probably more room for them to come down further before they level out and come up. So that we see investors taking a back seat at a time when they're trying to sort out what the future revenue side is on the multifamily side. I might share a few more comments later about population, but Canada's population growth has slowed very rapidly in the last year. And that's one of the things that you're seeing flow through into rents. So that's a kind of a real economic effect, which is affecting that sector and will continue to do so for the next couple of years. And then finally, Omar, we have office. I have a lot of colleagues who are very positive about the office sector right now, not just colleagues in my company, but also a lot of the brokers that are looking at this industry, et cetera, because we are starting to see leasing rates come up. We are seeing a lot of competition for the remaining high quality space that there is in our downtown cores as we see some back to work orders, et cetera. And all of those are what you might call green shoots, but the forest is still brown, even though the green shoots are coming up. And Canada's market, which is only about an 800 million square foot market, has 1 million square feet of functionally obsolete space. And that's on the books of a lot of our key investors. And it's been very difficult to rationalize and either convert or redevelop that space and bring that capital out in order to invest in the type of space that we need. And so we're going to be looking at a number of years, I think, before we start to see a real normalization on the office side, despite the fact that we might be technically coming up on a cycle. It's not going to be a rapid investment cycle at this point in time. And that's a little bit concerning for me, continues to be concerning for me.
And what are some of the kind of biggest risks that you think CRE investors should be vigilant about in Canada over the next 6 to 18 months?
Well, I think that I've made some reference already to some of those headwinds that are blowing in right now. One of those is the demographic change. I mean, demographics is one of those things that, you know, as an economist and also as a real estate market analyst, you know, you're constantly vigilant of. I mean, you never write a prospectus for a building without bringing in some boilerplate about demographics. It's always there as an important factor, but it's always usually a background factor that doesn't change very fast. So it just sets a kind of a baseline factor. But Canada was growing at well over 1 million people per year for a few years in the post-pandemic period. In the last year, it has slowed to only about 300,000. And the growth forecast going forward is negative for a few years. We've never had a negative year before, but even over the next 10 years or so, only about 200 to 300,000 range, well below pre-pandemic norms. There may be an opportunity for a slower population environment to address some of the constraints that we had in our economy a couple of years ago, including a pretty severe housing shortage problem and also a pretty severe labor issue that was starting to emerge just last year, the unemployment rate moving up. But despite all of that, commercial real estate runs off of people. You know, the office sector and the industrial sector run off of people working in those spaces and moving goods around for people who live in our communities. And when that population growth slows, so does that underlying demand environment. And I've already spoken about the issues on multifamily that are really direct flow through as well. So I think that continues to be one of our biggest challenges and headwinds right now on commercial real estate. Second one really just has to be the investment environment. There is investment funds out there. There's investment interest out there, but transactions continue to remain somewhat subdued across our major markets. And so that continues to be a headwind right now, just to see when in transactions are going to start finding their level and picking up again.
Are there any particular areas or niche sectors or certain strategies that you are seeing more optimism around?
On the industrial side, we see a number of niches emerging, and those niches are important, and they're attracting investment for sure. Data centers would be one. This is a big parallel to the U.S. In fact, it's a small parallel to the U.S. It's just a small offshoot, really. But we see a fair amount of investment activity, particularly in Alberta, where there's a lot of interest in providing the land for that sort of thing, but also that there's great power sources available. And then secondly, in Ontario, where everyone from the government on down is trying to ensure that there's proper power in place and land approvals and so on and so forth for that segment. So I think we will see more investment coming in there as time goes on. The other niche that's been pretty steady for the last couple of years and that we still expect in the next 5 years to be big is cold storage. And again, everything's a parallel to some extent. We've seen this kind of pattern in the U.S. where the cold storage has been pushed, not just because of logistics supply chain stuff, which is, of course, professionalizing itself. But in addition to that, a cycle of replacement of obsolete space, basically the stuff which is 40 years old and insufficient. And we're seeing that right now, and that's a big area. So I think those are big. I think the big logistics centers that have fueled the boom over the last 4 years in industrial, we're starting to see the bloom come off of that, but we are seeing these niches come out. And then I'll just point over to the office side. I've said it's still a brown forest where there might be some green shoots, but some of those green shoots are high quality space in really great locations. And I think there might be some opportunities for some investment to come into that. Maybe not going to see trophy towers for a while because we won't have the financing environment quite in place, I don't think, for the next couple of years to see any of those come in place, but probably smaller niche office projects in great locations. We'll probably start to see a few of those as well.
And Peter, I know that you've also spent a lot of time on housing. How would you characterize Canada's housing market going forward?
Yeah, so Canada's housing sector is under a certain amount of stress right now, and everybody's scrambling around looking for solutions. But one thing that is important is that the resale market is soft, but okay, kind of normally soft, like it's not that bad. We saw, for instance, in the spring in BC and Ontario, so two very major population centers, as housing transactions, resale housing transactions, fall off quite a bit during the springtime, but in other provinces, not. So it's a little bit of a mixed bag. But in general, on a national start, and now since the spring, things have kind of normalized on a year-over-year basis. So people are still buying homes. The resale activity is still happening okay. We're not seeing prices shooting up again, or they're nice and flat, but we are seeing transactions happening at a relatively normal rate. On the new construction side, things have fallen off the cliff. If I go through a kind of a list of what the year-over-year change in sales is for new home sales in major cities across the country, I would be using numbers like down 95%. Down 90%, down 85%, down 70%, depending on which major city I'm talking about. That's on new construction sales. In Canada, just about all new construction sales are pre-construction housing. Like, I'm talking about obviously ownership housing here because I'm not using the word sale. And in almost all of these markets, the whole pre-construction market has pretty much come to a halt. And that's in stark contrast to what I just said about the resale market. So it's not that the consumer isn't there per se, but it is that there's a nervousness about that market. It may also be that the pre-construction model is broken, that consumers no longer have the wherewithal or patience to buy a pre-construction condo and take possession of it 2, 3, 4, 5 years later, depending on how long the project takes to come to fruition. And it may also be that those projects that are marketing themselves right now are still marketing themselves more or less at 2024 prices, and prices in the overall market have adjusted down in that time. So this is a big concern to a lot of our clients, obviously, because they're trying to build these projects and we're trying to get them out of it. It's also a concern nationally because only a few years ago, the major discussion was we had a housing shortage and we weren't doing enough to get supply into the pipeline. Now with sales collapsing, housing starts are probably going to follow, at least for a while, because of these lower sales, the lags that come through. And those types of shortages will only exacerbate themselves going forward. This whole thing is like a pressure cooker with the valve taken off for a little while because of the population slowdown. But nonetheless, we still need to bring new housing to market in order to ultimately adjust the affordability levels that led to the crisis in the first place. So that continues to be a big concern right now about how we're going to bring new housing to market.
It's in the U.S., there's a big kind of affordability crisis. And with the current administration, as well as many of the industry groups, there's this growing pressure and push for addressing it via the supply side by removing or loosening up some of the policy, whether it's at the national level or at the local level. Like, how much juice is in the policy levers to kind of address Canada's housing?
Well, there's two different sides or streams, I guess you might say, in terms of government intervention or government policy that would kind of address that question. And one stream is about like direct investment and incentives. And we have seen for the last about 4 years or so, a kind of a steady increase in incentives dribbling into the sector. The federal government has had some money. Some provincial governments have had some money that they've been able to provide as incentives, either as low-cost loans, for example, in order to address financing, or transferring monies through some other schemes. Generally speaking, a lot of those types of incentives have come with additional criteria that ultimately sometimes doesn't make the investment incentive quite as good. For instance, there might be some low-cost loan that also comes with a requirement to add affordable housing or maybe to go above the climate standards for that building, and both of which might add some costs as well as getting the low-cost. So it doesn't necessarily change things. But nonetheless, there has been a stream of these sorts of investment funds. Most recently, the federal government has just set up a whole new agency called Build Canada Homes, and it's using money directly to build, basically, or to partner with builders, but it's really just direct building funds growing directly. And that's mainly social housing, which is something Canada hasn't built for 30 years. There hasn't been any government-built housing, and they're just starting to do that. So that's all one side of streets. The other stream, I suppose, the other side of the equation is just planning policy and growth policy, all of which can either be a massive headwind or a tailwind, depending on how well it's done. And I would characterize, certainly in the busier parts of Canada, which would be Ontario and BC in particular, a little bit in Alberta, that the last 30 years have been one where planning policy has become more and more of a headwind all the time. And right now, there's a need to unwind a lot of that. And so the slowdown in housing, or even the drastic slowdown, as I described earlier, in new ownership housing, may be a real kick in the pants, to use a technical term, in terms of finally addressing some of those headwinds. Those headwinds come in the form of, in some cases, very long approval timelines, and also uneven approval timelines. We did a study just earlier this year that showed that to get a kind of a typical residential, high-rise residential development approved, the timelines varied from over 24 months in some jurisdictions, like the city of Toronto, to only about 4 months, like in other jurisdictions, principally in Alberta. And, you know, to have that much variability, and time is money, right? This is just to get your plan approved. It's not to do all the rest of what you need to do. So those are headwinds, certainly in jurisdictions where it takes so long to get things approved. And then the other thing is just the level of government charges in general that are set against new construction. That has been increasing and increasing over the last number of years, really over the last 20 years or so, including infrastructure charges, including taxation on the ultimate house and so on and so forth, so that taxes on houses now are above 35% in some cases, and one of the most taxed sectors that there is. And so that's a headwind to development as well. So we would like to see a lot of that stuff erased or migrated into more of a tailwind than a headwind.
Fantastic. And yeah, that 4 to 24 months, like even the average is useless there, right? If that's your, wow, that's huge. Well, Peter, thank you so much for talking with me today. I really learned a lot, and I hope to see you on the show again. All right, and a big thank you to Peter for sharing his views on Canada's dominant CRE trends. If you want to hear more about our northern neighbors or the Canada CRE market and weren't able to catch the full State of the Market event live yesterday, you can go to the link in the show notes to find that webinar recording. And with that, Cole, how about we close out this episode and we can end it with the events that you're watching or have on your radar for the week to come?
Yeah. So despite the government shutdown, we still have a number of releases to pay attention to. And I also do want to call out that we'll be deep in the midst of REIT earnings calls. So starting on Tuesday, October 28th, we'll get the S&P Case-Shiller Home Price Index, the Conference Board's Consumer Confidence Index, and a number of REIT calls that day: Curbline, Welltower, Brixmore, Net Street, Kilroy, and Alexandria. So a lot of retail that day. Wednesday, October 29th, we'll get pending home sales. There's an FOMC interest rate decision that'll probably dominate the news that day, but a number of REIT earnings calls as well: Urban Edge, BXP, Highwoods, Regency, WP Carey, and Equity Residential. And then on Thursday, October 30th, a number of REIT earnings calls: Whitestone, Kimco, Stag, Mid-America Apartments, Empire State Realty Trust, Public Storage, and Avalon Bay. So I know one of our most listened to episodes is typically our coverage of REIT earnings calls. So we'll be paying attention to a number of those, but some good ones on the agenda for next week. But Omar, I think that's all the time we've got today. Before we sign off, I want to encourage our listeners, if you like the show, we'd love it if you could rate it. Please give us 5 stars on Apple and Spotify. Leave us comments there as well. We'd be happy to read them. Or feel free to just send us an email. We've got altusresearch@altusgroup.com. We'd love to know what topics you'd like covered on the program. In the meantime, Omar, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to speaking with you on another episode of CRE Exchange. Have a good one.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a leading provider of CRE intelligence. We connect data, analytics, applications, and expertise to power CRE performance. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.